Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest in You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. Senator Jeff Woodburn was arrested yesterday on charges of domestic violence, and politicians from both major parties call for him to resign immediately. A State Department of Education employee sparks outrage with a racially charged Facebook post, and the two Democratic candidates for governor debate in a public forum ahead of the September primary. These and other stories made headlines this week, and we will talk about them in this hour. You can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. We're also broadcasting a live streaming video of this radio program, so you can check it out at NHPR Exchange Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. And here to talk about the week's news and answer your questions are Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, Trent Spinner of the Union Leader, and Ethan DeWitt of the Concord Monitor. Thank you very much for being here, everybody.
Thanks. Hey, Peter.
Thanks.
Again, listeners, phone number for you to join the conversation, 1-800-892-6477. So we learned yesterday afternoon that Senator Jeff Woodburn, Democrat from Whitefield, was arrested on domestic violence charges. Trent, what do we know so far about these allegations?
What we know is that the Attorney General has been investigating these domestic assault crimes now for several months. He allegedly did a number of things to an intimate partner. He threw an empty cup of water at her. He bit her on her hand. These are all allegations that the Attorney General's office released yesterday. Woodburn said that he found out about the charges yesterday and turned himself in. He was arrested. And what happened almost immediately, actually, even before the Attorney General's press release came out, was that a number of people called for him to resign. The first person to do so was the chairman of the Democratic Party, Ray Buckley. But then following that, almost everyone from the Republican Senate president to the Democratic congressional delegation have called on Woodburn to resign. Woodburn says, I'm not ready to resign at this point. I'm gonna answer to these charges and is not looking to resign at this time.
Yeah, he's facing 9 misdemeanor counts, including simple assault, domestic violence, and criminal mischief involving, as Trent said, some hitting and biting and kicking in a door over almost a period of almost roughly a year, I think a couple of different incidents. And as Trent said, immediate calls for him to resign. He obviously wants his day in court. I think probably the only voice I heard echoing that was, I think, Lou D'Alessandro said that, you know, it's troubling, but he deserves his day in court. So we'll see what happens down the road politically. The pressure keeps up for him to resign, if he, in fact, refuses to resign, et cetera. You know, the difference here compared to other states is the state Senate term is only 2 years. So he has to run for reelection. He's in his third term, I believe, and he'd have to run for reelection in November.
And what's the political angle here? I mean, we should stress that these are just allegations at this point. Lou D'Alessandro saying he needs to stay in court. He might be the outlier. It seems like all the other politicians I've seen with their press releases and tweets are saying resign immediately. What are the political implications here? Ethan?
Well, so I should note that of the 10 Democrats in the Senate, 8 of the 9, other than Woodburn, did call on Senator Woodburn to step down, Senator D'Alessandro being the exception. So there's momentum at least within the caucus, there's, as Trent pointed out, there was swift momentum from all levels of the party infrastructure, starting at the Democratic Party chair to the congressional delegation. Everybody had statements, and everybody was unequivocal: resign now, resign immediately. So there, when you look at in terms of the politics, at least in terms from the party's perspective and from others' perspective, it's a clear-cut situation of you know, they're looking to have him resign. As far as what happens next and whether he will resign, those are some very open questions at this point.
Right. He hasn't indicated that he wants to.
No. He hasn't made any statement beyond saying that he would address the charges in court and speak to them. And defend himself in court, but he hasn't said anything about the status of his campaign. And I should note, it's actually very tricky to, once you the filing period is over, it is very tricky to for a party to forcibly remove a candidate. There are very limited situations in which a candidate can be taken off the ballot. And I spoke to Secretary of State Bill Gardner this morning. And he said that there's basically three scenarios that you can go through. It's either a death, or there's some incapacitation that's determined by a doctor, physical or mental incapacitation, or the candidate moves from the district and is no longer eligible to be a candidate there.
Mm. So he's saying that even though the filing period has closed, if he were to resign, his name would still show up on the ballot?
There is actually a specific RSA that prohibits the withdrawal of candidates after the...
from the ballot.
So even if he wanted to resign and stay in District 1 in the Senate, he would not be able to remove his name from the ballot until he was an unqualified candidate. And the only way to become an unqualified candidate, Gardner told me, other than having some sort of physical or mental impairment determined by a doctor, is to leave the district and actually actively register to vote in another district and establish domicile there as well. So that's a step. If he decides to go along with the strong calls by the party, he would have to find some way to make that happen. Otherwise, there's going to have to be some sort of write-in campaign.
Trent?
And just consider this. Woodburn is the highest-ranking Democrat at the State House, and he has served a number of terms. He's a player in Democratic politics. He's raising money for other candidates. And let's look back to his last election. Woodburn beat Dolly McFall, who was incredibly well-known in the North Country, was anti-Northern Pass, was an activist for many years about that, and Woodburn still won by several thousand votes. And so there is this potential where he can stay on the ballot. Potentially the charges are either ongoing at the time of the election or they're not. And he could still win even without support of the Democratic primary, without the Democratic establishment, because consider that people up there know him. They voted for him several times. It's possible that they don't pay attention to this news. And so there is a chance, I think, where he stays on the ballot. He wins his seat again. I don't know if the Democratic caucus in the Senate will allow him to be the minority leader or the majority leader, whatever happens in that election. But I mean, I do see a path for him. And given that he's not going to resign and given that it didn't even say that he's going to suspend his campaign, I think that it would seem like they also see a path here.
Mm-hmm. Listeners, if you'd like to join the conversation, the phone number is 1-800-892-6477. Breaking news story about Senator Jeff Woodburn being arrested yesterday on charges of domestic violence. 1-800-892-6477. And let's talk to Katie in Derry. Katie, thank you very much for calling. What's your question or comment?
Hi there. So I'm just calling in. I guess my question or comment is directed specifically at Trent from the Union Leader. So it's my understanding that every single other media outlet in the state has agreed not to publish victims' names, especially in situations of domestic violence and sexual assault. So I'm not sure why you all felt the need to, yesterday in a tweet and also in your article, publish this person's name, because it could put her in jeopardy of, further harm. And it honestly feels like it's sensationalizing domestic violence.
Okay, Katie, thank you very much. So publishing the name of an alleged victim, Trent, what do you say to that?
We did not name the victim in the story, and I would urge her to read the story.
Did she also allege a tweet, I believe it was? Was there
There was a tweet from a reporter, mm-hmm. and as soon as the coalition alerted it to me, we deleted it and we replaced it.
Mm-hmm. And so is it generally speaking the union leader's policy not to name alleged victims?
It's a case-by-case basis.
Okay. Yeah. NHPR's policy, which we discussed before the show here today, is to not name alleged victims of domestic violence. Trent, thank you very much for answering that question. Listeners, if you have other questions about this, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org. One question I had about the procedure based on a tweet that I saw, which was that the state Democratic Party was sort of ahead of the state's attorney general's office in releasing information about this. Is there anything to make of that, Ethan?
There's a few things. First of all, a party insider said that they were informed shortly before the arrest. And there's a potential timeline for that as well. He was alerted. There was a warrant article obtained by the Department of Justice on Wednesday night. And then sometime Thursday, Senator Woodburn said it was Thursday afternoon. The attorney general did not confirm what time of day it was. But sometime he was served that warrant. Or made notified of that warrant, and he chose to turn himself in to the Concord Police Department. So somewhere in that window, there are, of course, many people he could have told, including the party leadership, that would have prompted that that statement. My suspicion is that there was some media attention ahead of the Attorney General's release and that the party got ahead of itself. But that being said, on that particular day, there are still very big questions moving forward in terms of what was known and kind of what might have been done earlier.
Questions about what the Democratic Party knew?
Well, not necessarily the party, but certain members or whether the senator had any sort of political allies who knew about this and sort of what actions they may have taken. I will say that, we had heard tips and rumors about this, these allegations, and even this investigation as far back as a week before the arrest yesterday. So there was at least a small circle of people who knew of the allegations before the arrest. And the question is kind of how big that circle was and kind of who, it might have intersected with. And that's something that we'll have to do some reporting on in the weeks to come.
Yeah, that's the big question. It was interesting yesterday when this all broke, watching kind of the state GOP Twitter feed, and there was a lot made of the fact that Ray Buckley's statement for the Democratic Party came out shortly before the official announcement. It was like 15 minutes or something. And, this is the kind of situation where either something like that is going to leak out because he's a high-profile individual, or he could have conceivably given them a quick heads up. I don't think, given the political impact of this, that would be an unreasonable thing to do. There's nothing wrong with that. The bigger question is, this is a pattern of alleged behavior that goes back at least to last December. So that's the question, is whether or not other, key Democrats in the state were kind of aware of this, or, what prior knowledge did they have? How was it dealt with, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know that. But if you're going to ask questions about who knew what when, it's not about why the Democrats put out a notice 15 minutes early. It's, this is allegedly has been going on for a while. Who knew about it?
Sure. Listeners, we'll come back to this topic. If you have questions or comments, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Also coming up on the program today, stories of diversity and inclusion. A State Department of Education employee was condemned by the governor and the commissioner of education for making racially charged statements on social media about a gathering of business leaders in the state who were pushing to find ways to fill open positions, perhaps with people from other states. Maybe those people were also going to be adding some diversity, racial diversity to the state. What do you think about those comments? What do you think about that meeting itself? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Ethan, I wanted to ask you about a story you did this week, because you reported for the Concord Monitor that the New Hampshire House received 7 complaints of harassment by members and staff working at the State House this year. This was 6 more than had previously been reported. What were those complaints, and why had they not been disclosed earlier?
Sure. I should note that this was in response to public records requests by a number of media organizations, including the Concord Monitor and NHPR. In terms of the disclosure, a lot of that has to do with the redactions. The House Legal Counsel is very careful to redact names and any identifying information from these reports. But the way that this works, and this has been reported on for over the last year by different New Hampshire organizations, complaints, any sort of complaints that are harassment complaints or other conduct complaints are made to the House Chief of Staff, Terry Pfaff. And he writes fairly detailed memos in which he will interview the complainer, also interview any witnesses to the behavior. And he'll file those memos and release them publicly once names have been redacted. So that's what happened this week. The release of six more that were previously unreported, seven total for the year, complaints were released. And it kind of showed a big range. But one thing it did show is that people seem to be more aware of the reporting process in the House. And that's probably in large part due to the Me Too movement and to a lot of negative attention that the body got last year when it was revealed that that a quarter of the House had not actually signed off that they had even acknowledged or seen the harassment protocol. Mm-hmm. So among the complaints that were released, some of them were representatives complaining against other representatives. One of them was a staff member who was complaining about a year-long pattern of hostility, as she put it. From one representative who had called her an old bat and the granny in the corner and had said these comments in front of her in her office and in front of other staff members. And when asked about it, the lawmaker said it was a good-natured banter, something like a brother and sister relationship. But she said it created a kind of insidious environment that she felt very threatened by. There was a lawmaker who complained about a lobbyist who was opposed to the bill that she was sponsoring, and she felt was berating her and in outside of the statehouse grounds and within. There was a complaint against a lawmaker by two staff people who had been confronted by this lawmaker every time they had tried to return to their cars. They had a set parking spot, and the representative knew that and would honk his horn and yell things at them and then became kind of aggressive when they tried to ignore him. And in every one of these cases, there have been different outcomes. One of them involved that latter one, involving the car park, involved the attorney general at one point. But in most cases, there was some sort of resolution by the House Chief of Staff where the party that was being accused agreed not to continue the behavior, and the accusing party agreed to accept that resolution.
Is this a sign of positive change that this is actually being addressed and also publicized? We know about these things now?
Well, that's certainly what the House Chief of Staff is arguing. He's saying that some of these didn't rise to the level of maybe sexual harassment. One of them was a heated exchange after a bill in which one person said, good luck getting reelected or something to that effect after your vote. And the other person said good luck as well. And then that comment was reported. So that may not have risen to the level of harassment, but it's still welcomed and it's still important, the Chief of Staff said, because it allows the behavior to be noticed, to be checked, and to be stopped. And he said it's a positive thing that more people are comfortable coming to him and resolving these things because the behavior, he says, does stop.
Yeah. Well, Ethan, thank you very much for joining us for this part of the show and sharing details of your reporting with us. Really appreciate it.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. Dean Spiliotis and Trent Spinner are going to stick around. We're going to continue to talk about the week's news, including many stories involving diversity, inclusion, and racially charged language. Give us a call if you've got questions about the week's news. The number is 1-800-892-6477. You can also email exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, which is where you can watch a live video of this radio program. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back.
I'm Laura Canoy. The Exchange has been going local all summer, exploring the unique regions of New Hampshire. And as part of our series, we'll be heading to Keene, the heart of the Monadnock region, to discuss the biggest issues facing that area and what residents love most about their home. The show will be live at Keene State College on August 16th at 9 a.m. So reserve your free tickets now at nhpr.org/events.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello here in the studio with Trent Spinner of the Union Leader and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. And with you, give us a call if you have questions or comments about the week's news. 1-800-892-6477. This week, Anthony Shinella, the communications director for the Department of Education, landed in hot water for having made some racially charged statements that some called racist that he said weren't racially motivated at all. He was responding to a story on Facebook about some New Hampshire business leaders gathered to discuss diversity. And I wanted to make sure we were all on the same page with what Anthony Shinella said on Facebook, so I'm going to read it for you. And the quote begins, "We don't want or need New Hampshire to become any kind of cesspool. We have enough problems, and many of us don't want or need to pay more taxes because the new people moving in expect the same things they had in their other states. We are small. We don't have the ability to tax our way out of problems." Anthony Shinella continues, "Diversity for diversity's sake doesn't bring us anything. An extreme example? 1,300 illegal alien Dominican drug dealers moving from Lawrence to, say, Concord will make the state 1% more diverse, but it would also bring more crime, higher taxes for public safety, and higher taxes for schools to teach their children." End quote. That is a lot to unpack, perhaps unpacking maybe the most prominent responses to it. Governor Chris Sununu and Commissioner of Education Frank Edelblue both condemned the statement. Frank Edelblue saying, "I and the Department of Education condemn this statement and any racist statement." That's from Frank Edelblue. So, Trent Spinner, Dean Spiliotis, I wanted to get your reaction on both what was said and the official reaction. We'll start with you, Trent.
I've known Tony for 10 years, and I've been Facebook friends with him for most of that time. And just as background, I'm not going to make any judgments about what he said there, but I can tell you that there have been – he has opined on everything from – downtown Main Street, Concord reconstruction to national politics. And there's a fiery debate on his Facebook page. He was also the editor of Concord Patch just before this job. And part of what Patch's ethos was that their editors should be in the community and should be getting discussions going. Sometimes he would post things on social media that if one of my reporters posted, we would have to have a discussion about it. But it was part of the Patch mentality that the local editors should be driving the debate in their towns. And I'm not making a judgment about what he said here. And I think that clearly being in a state job, working as a public information officer, the number one rule of being somebody else's spokesperson is you can't be the story. And clearly that did not happen here.
Yeah, if nothing else, this raises the raises the issue of the pitfalls of personal social media. You know, people have discussions now on social media that they may have had in the privacy of their own homes in the past, and we wouldn't have known about them. But now this stuff is up there for everyone to see. I don't know this individual. I did read I read the New York Times article that reported on the diversity meeting that occurred here recently, and then this was his comments were a response to that article. When I read his comments, I don't know him. I can't speak to his character necessarily, but the comments gave me pause for sure.
Well, why?
Just the nature of the, you know, it sort of fell back into the sort of the typical discussions we've had in the state, the stereotyping about he talked about illegal Dominican drug dealers moving up to Concord and whether that would really help diversity. He talked about, not wanting to turn the state into a cesspool. You know, basically we fell back into the standard characterization of a particular ideological viewpoint that you don't want minorities here. You don't want immigrants. You don't want poor people. That's in my view, that was the subtext. Whether it's racist or not, people can decide for themselves. As I said, I don't know the individual. But as I said, the comments gave me pause because it feeds into kind of a familiar ideological viewpoint that we're hearing increasingly vocally in the country about immigration, about the extent to which government has a responsibility to help people who are in poverty, and also just in general the issue of minority representation and diversity. So that's what it was about. We'll see what comes as a result of this. But again, it's the pitfalls of social media and this idea that when you put stuff out there, people are going to see it.
Well, listeners, we'd love to know what you think of Anthony Shinella's comments. Please call us 1-800-892-6477. 6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. So in continuing Frank Edelblue's statement, he said the department is taking all appropriate and available disciplinary actions. What could those be? Could Shinello lose his job over this?
Theoretically, he has a First Amendment right to have his own opinion. And there are RSAs that allow state employees to have, you know, opinions on social media. And I think that I think he's in a union as well. And so there are, you know, you can't just fire somebody. There has to be a whole process. Edelblue said that he was going to reprimand Shinello. And so I think we may actually never find out what happened because that's all personnel records. But, you know, I think it
doesn't sound like Governor Sununu has the ability to dismiss him directly, if my understanding
absolutely
is correct.
Absolutely not. No, I mean, no, he couldn't do that. The governor couldn't fire Edelblue if he really wanted to. I mean, right? It's a whole separate department. The governor, you know, the commissioner is appointed by the governor and the executive council. And so, yeah, the governor can't just swoop in and fire a state employee.
Mm-hmm. Listeners, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Apparently that meeting on diversity for some of the state's business leaders was a huge conversation generator this week. In the union leader, Trent, I know you can't talk about this, but I wanted to bring it up. The union leader published an editorial this week called "New Hampshire is Too White. Diversify or Die," the new motto. That was the title. And it was also criticizing or asking people to look critically at the business's efforts and the governor's efforts to look beyond borders to fill positions and increase diversity. That editorial included the lines, quote, "Don't look now, but other states having similar workforce problems have business and sometimes governments looking beyond U.S. borders for workers. Without some sensible regulations as to who gets in, New Hampshire and the nation are going to face more of the problems that are troubling and dividing Europe." So, Dean, I'll put it to you because you mentioned that you had pause over what Mr. Shinello had said.
Right.
Did this line also give you pause?
I think it was written a little bit more deliberately. I read it earlier. I just read it again in the break to make sure I was clear on what it said. And it's basically making the case, in a sense, and this is where there's a similarity to what Mr. Shinello was saying, that you can't micromanage diversity in the state. And in fact, Shinello in his comments said diversity for diversity's sake doesn't buy us anything. And so the editorial talks about rather than trying to micromanage the placement of diverse employees in the state, you know, whether it's the North Country or the southern tier of the state, that the state should focus more on lowering education costs, on keeping young people who are here in the state. That's something we've talked about before, and to keep track of where the costs that are paying for these sorts of diversity initiatives are how they're being paid. So it was more kind of a discussion of structural challenges that everyone in the country is facing, given that we're close to full employment at this point, and certainly in New Hampshire there's a labor shortage in many respects. But it was the same sort of issue about the same sort of sense of if diversity may be a problem for New Hampshire, but it's not something you can really micromanage without having unintended consequences for the lifestyle and the sort of the nature of the state.
Mm-hmm. Listeners, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, and let's talk to Dan in Farmington. Dan, thanks very much for calling.
Hi, good morning. And it sounds like I just caught the tail end of that comment as I was getting off the line with your screener. So it sounds like you may have just now at least touched on what I was going to say. And that is, human beings, we are tribal by nature. And whether it be race or ethnicity or religion or hair color or gender or sex, we have a tendency to view the world in us's and them's. And I wonder if the interpretation of the comments about diversity having possibly negative consequences, I wonder if the common interpretation of that comment as being racist by itself is more projection from the listener or reader of the comment of their own racial apprehensions, and if that context is not necessarily intended by the original poster.
So you're asking a question about intent. Does right. the intent it, of it, the speaker matter?
Yes, and whether or not the speaker, or in this case the poster, who I don't remember the exact quote, but I do remember the quote not having anything to do with a particular race, and I and something about crime rates. And I went, you know, when you get large numbers of tribal people together into a smaller space, there's bound to be some tension between us's and them's, no matter who or what or what the us's or them's look like or sound like or act like. We're tribal by nature. And I don't necessarily view the comment as racist on its own.
Okay. I mean, just to clarify, Dan, because Anthony Shinella did say, as an extreme example, 1,300 illegal alien Dominican drug dealers, which may have been one of the trigger words that caused some folks to say that this was indeed racially based in some way. But I get your point, because one of the things about this conversation about race and diversity, this is a conversation we had with our producers before the show, is intent, exactly what you mentioned, Dan. Does the intent of the speaker, of the writer, matter? If they believe they are racist or if they believe they are not racist, does that somehow color their question? This is an open question. This is something that we in the news team are discussing. This is something that our listeners are discussing. This is something that they write us about. And it's something that can't honestly be unpacked in the context of a show like this. Wish it were so. And I'm sort of encouraging the news team here to have more conversations about this. But maybe I'm talking too much. And Dean, can I ask you to weigh in on Dan's thoughts here?
Yeah, I'm sort of thinking through as kind of a meta comment or more philosophical comment about people bringing their own prejudices and understandings to whatever they read versus the intentions of the poster. So the example would be, if the poster says something is not racist, if they believe it's not racist, then can it really be racist? I mean, that's a tough question to answer. As I said in my earlier comments, my concerns were about, the example you just used and, using the phrase about turning New Hampshire into cesspool. I think that's a loaded comment. And for a lot of people, that has it. If it's not overtly racist, it clearly leads to sort of certain ways of thinking about different populations that might live in New Hampshire. So, sure, everybody brings their interpretations to what they read. Some people might say it's intention. Others might say it's a lack of self-awareness on the part of the poster. But that's a philosophical debate that I think we're going to keep having. And, we're in the midst of a huge national version of that debate right now, certainly with President Trump.
Well, let's I guess descend from the clouds of philosophy and bring it back to the week's news. Apologies for the diversion, everybody. But
not a bad place to stay.
Actually, yeah.
A little bit of time there.
It's okay. Give us a call if you have questions or comments. 1-800-892-6477. Another story having to do with race has to come from the Civil Rights Unit here in New Hampshire. The Department of Justice filed its first case. It involves a hotel worker in the town of Jackson. She faces, her name is Priscilla Protesevicki, and she is facing charges of for alleged statements during an altercation with two Muslim guests. Trent, what is known about this incident?
So here's what we know. As you said, it's the first case being prosecuted by the Civil Rights Unit. The allegation is that the inn owner used some racial terms because of the customer's religion, and essentially physically forced them out. So that's where the actual criminal charge comes in.
There's some physical contact.
Right. There was some physical contact, and I forget what the exact charge was, if it was simple assault or something a little higher than that. But because of the alleged assault plus the racial comments, the Civil Rights Unit got involved. The defense says, the innkeeper's attorney says, that there was a dispute about some 9/11 memorabilia that was inside. There was no physical violence, so this is going to play out in court. It will be interesting to see how this unit operates.
And one of the interesting things about this is that the woman who was accused of making these comments, Priscilla Protesevicki, has been speaking to the press about this. NHPR's Todd Bookman had spoken with her earlier this week, and she had this to say about what happened.
I mean, this had nothing to do with race. It's the fact that they didn't even want to stay here. I wanted them to stay here. I've had Muslims stay here for a week, and they're very nice people. They played with my kids. I invited them up to my private living quarters. But these people were just scum like you wouldn't believe. These people in particular were like, I don't know, radicalized or something.
So Priscilla Protasevicki speaking there, and according to NHPR's report on this, she didn't really elaborate on what was meant by radicalized and why that would translate to a certain kind of behavior at a hotel in northern New Hampshire. But Elizabeth Leahy leads the AG's civil rights unit, and she had this to say about the case.
It's not uncommon in New Hampshire. I think New Hampshire thinks of itself as sort of immune, and it's not.
Immune to, I guess, kind of racially charged behavior. And Leahy also recaps the allegation.
There were comments made about the patrons' religion and national origin, and in particular that they shouldn't be there and aren't supposed to be there because of their religion.
So this is a tough story, I think, to hear for folks in New Hampshire who want to believe that they are not racist, because this provides ammunition for folks who want to say that, yeah, the state can be pretty racist. I'm not sure if that's true or what's going to happen exactly, but what's the next step here? Do we just wait and see what happens at the court?
I think we need to wait to see. It sounds like there's a little bit of a he said, she said, or I think it's actually she said, going on here about what really happened. And so I think that the criminal case will have to proceed. There will be a presentation of the facts, and then a jury or a judge will decide. And I think we have to see what ends up happening with that.
Well, it's interesting to me that, and I'm not a lawyer, but it's interesting to me that the woman is speaking out in the way she is, and that her defense attorneys aren't trying to have her wait until the actual case progresses. You know, the comments about radicalization combined with all the other stuff. You know, this gets us back to this early issue about, you know, just if someone says it's not racist, does that make it not racist? Is it the prejudices or the way in which people interpret it, or is it a lack of self-awareness of the individual? You know, we're not going to resolve that here, but this is very similar to what we've been talking about for the last 15 minutes or so.
Yeah, and last story that we should talk about with respect to diversity, and it appeared in the Union Leader today. This is really important. Going back again to that meeting of business leaders and folks who were concerned about, you know, making the state a more diverse place, somehow the list of people who attended has been circulating, and now some of those people are receiving death threats. Trent, this was in the Union Leader this morning.
Right. So just to go back, this is a group of nonprofit leaders, government officials, businesses who say because the state has such low it's so difficult to hire workers, we need to figure out ways to attract other people of different races, religions, sexual orientations, family situations, whatever it is. We need to figure out a way to make people like that feel comfortable, like they can live in New Hampshire. And we need to look at the ways that we do that. And so there's no state funding behind it or anything. This is just a convening of people who are interested in this issue. So we actually tweeted a list of the attendees. And what happened was a white nationalist group took our reporter's tweet, and they went through the list line by line by line. And they, on their website, found photos, phone numbers, email addresses of everyone who attended this meeting. And they've been posting on their site urging people to get in touch with them, with the people who were at this meeting, asking them to completely stop their efforts. And what has happened is that this has spun through white nationalist blogs and websites throughout the country. And people from all across the country are now writing to people here in New Hampshire who attended that meeting. Some of them are death threats. Some of them are very scary things. And they have all been referred to the Attorney General's office for a potential criminal investigation.
All right. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. We're broadcasting a live video today's radio show as well. You can check that out on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. Coming up, we've got news from the campaign trail, and NHPR's Lauren Chulgen will join us. If you've got questions about the many candidates running for CD1, perhaps, or questions about the two Democratic candidates for governor, they met for a debate this week. We'll talk about that. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, email exchange@nhpr.org, or, of course, post on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. We'll learn more in just a few. This is NHPR. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello here in the studio with Trent Spinner of the Union Leader, Dean Spiliotis of SNHU, and now NHPR's Lauren Chooljian's here with us. Hey, Lauren.
Hey.
So let's talk about some political news. Former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani was in New Hampshire this week to endorse Eddie Edwards in the race to win the Republican nomination for the state's first congressional district. Why did Giuliani say that Edwards is the best candidate?
Well, he believes in Edwards' conservative live free or die and America first values. That was kind of like the general consensus there. It didn't seem like they had known each other for many years. It wasn't that they had this long-standing relationship or anything. Giuliani is close with Wayne Semprini, who's a former head of the New Hampshire Republican Party and also led Giuliani's presidential campaign in New Hampshire. And it was Wayne who introduced Giuliani to Edwards. So Edwards' campaign is kind of making this push right now to court Trump supporters. And so this is obviously a big part of that push. There were all sorts of Trump superfans at this Portsmouth event with all kinds of, you know, Make America Great Again hats and stickers and all that jazz.
Were they there more for the president's lawyer than for Eddie Edwards?
Well, so I think they were certainly there for Eddie Edwards, but there was a lot of, you know, different people that were in the Trump campaign in New Hampshire were there and getting to know Eddie Edwards. But I think, like I said in my story, I mean, if there were any doubts that the Edwards campaign is courting Trump supporters, I mean, those all evaporated because this was all about Edwards and his support of the president. He said the president is doing, quote, one hell of a job. And Giuliani even went as far to say that the Edwards thinks just like and sees the world just like the president does. So that connection was made. And I think that was the big part of this endorsement.
Yeah. So it seems like Eddie Edwards has a lot of the momentum here. What's happening with the other candidates, Andy Sanborn?
So the two Republicans, it seems like ever since two major Republican candidates, I should say, ever since Bruce Crochetier dropped out, it has been quite heated. The two of them, Sanborn and Edwards, have really gone toe-to-toe on pretty much everything. And so I think we'll see a lot of that in the last, you know, a month or so to go here before the primary. So on the Republican side, that is definitely the focus right now, the campaign, that it is starting to get quite heated between the two of them.
Yeah. Okay. Also in the news this week, having to do with the campaign trail, is that the two Democratic candidates for New Hampshire governor sort of did their best to differentiate themselves at a forum in Exeter on Wednesday night. Rockingham County Democrats hosted an event with Molly Kelly and Steve Marchand. Dean, what's your impression there? How did they set themselves apart?
Well, it's interesting, you know, the larger context here, and I've said this many times before, is I think that, you know, Governor Sununu's likelihood of reelection, I think, is going to be driven as much by the larger context. And if we go back to the Giuliani example, there really seems to be a strategic decision that has been made by the Trump administration that, or certainly by Donald Trump, that the best bet for minimizing Republican losses in the midterm is to nationalize this, say that, you know, Democrats are just looking to impeach the president, try to make it feel like Trump supporters need to turn out, basically to mobilize base supporters. And Eddie Edwards has certainly embraced Donald Trump pretty substantially in recent weeks. So I think the bigger issue for Governor Sununu is this going to be a blue wave? You know, what are his chances of getting reelected? You know, the metrics for him generally look good, but it really depends on what turnout looks like. So within that context, it's maybe sort of less important who the Democratic nominee is, but nonetheless, they are in these forums that they're holding around the state, attempting to differentiate each other. And you know, Molly Kelly is talking a lot about her experience in the state Senate, and she's got virtually every major endorsement by a Democratic institutional elite in the state. Steve is running, as interestingly enough, is running as kind of a progressive outsider. Molly Kelly has pointed out that wasn't always his preferred ideological position, and she's kind of accused him of being you know, a little bit instrumental in trying to capitalize on whatever is left of the Bernie Sanders energy from 2016. They've talked a lot about, you know, energy programs, and, you know, Molly has argued that she was actually involved in doing these things in the state legislature. Steve has rolled out a bunch of different multi-point plans on policy. But that's that seems to be the larger context. You know, Molly Kelly is talking about her experience, her endorsements of other key policymakers. Steve is positioning himself as a progressive outsider, and she's accusing him of just doing that to get the nomination.
Trent? Oh, I'm sorry.
No. To Dean's point, I was going to say about this idea of the national election coming local. I mean, that is exactly the thing in CD1 as well, where just on Wednesday with Rudy Giuliani, that was a big part of what he said was that this is going to be an election about impeachment or non-impeachment. Yeah. And so if you're a Republican, do you think that the Democrats are going to treat the president fairly? And he also tried to paint the CD1 candidates as socialists. You know, so they are really trying to tap into this fear or energy from Republicans on the far right now that are watching what's going on nationally. And I think we'll see that on the Democrats.
Yeah, and sometimes if there is controversy at the national level, parties who are in danger of losing seats will often try to make the elections local. But in this case, they're going full speed in the opposite direction, hoping to mobilize Trump supporters by making it a national referendum. And to some extent, House races always are more nationalized than other kinds of races.
I think that going back to the governor's race here, I think that the Democratic primary is actually the most interesting race happening in New Hampshire right now. I think that what we're going to see here is where the true heart of the Democratic Party is. You have Kelly, who does have the endorsement of every basic Democratic establishment candidate, and you have Marchand, who is almost more progressive than Bernie Sanders. And let's not forget what happened here with Bernie and Hillary in 2016, right? Bernie won by 22 points. And so the question is, does that still exist in New Hampshire? Was that a fluke? Was that Bernie Sanders just being able to whip up momentum? Or is there space in the Democratic Party in New Hampshire for somebody like Steve Marchand, who doesn't, by the way, have the endorsement of Bernie Sanders, who doesn't necessarily have the endorsement of people who were with Bernie Sanders? Is there room for a progressive like that in the New Hampshire Democratic Party? And I think if Marchand wins this race, which I think is a long shot, if you just look at the fundraising numbers, I mean, he is being outspent by a huge amounts. It will show whether or not that 2016 election has carried over through 2018 or not.
It's so interesting because when CD1 all started, and I've been super interested in it, obviously, that was a question I was thinking about was, okay, I'll look at all these Democrats and I'll see if there's much of this, you know, more left, more progressive, more Bernie Sanders-esque wing of the party. Like, is that going to be the big debate? And because there's so many of them, and because turnout is going to be such a factor, and because, you know, votes going everywhere, you're not going to be able to determine that as much. But I haven't thought of it that way, that you can see it more in the governor's race than you can in CD1 because of that, just having those two people to look at.
Yeah, it's very helpful for the Democratic Party kind of sorting out where it is and where it will go going into 2020. That said, I think once we get to the general, I think there are a lot of other factors that are going to influence whether or not Sununu gets reelected beyond whether he's facing Marchand or Kelly. And I think a lot of that's going to have to do with the larger national context.
Lauren, you did a great story this week about how the Democratic Party is really trying to make both candidates and voters sort of play nice with each other. And Ray Buckley was at the center of that, the chairperson of the party. So what did he have to say?
Yeah, so a couple of, it's like the beginning of the summer, I was at a forum at Kennett Middle School Library in Conway. And it's a forum like they had last night where the Democratic Party is running a forum for all the CD1 candidates on the Democratic side. And Ray Buckley is the moderator of these events. And so this time he kicked off the forum by giving them a little bit of advice.
Folks, we only have 8 weeks between the primary and the general election. And if you all get on your Facebook pages and your Twitter accounts and start thinking the best way you can help your candidate is to rip the living stuffing out of somebody else, you're only creating bad blood.
And so this idea that this bad blood could be created through negative comments or saying something mean about another candidate, that wasn't just for voters. That was also for the candidates as well. And this has kind of been a tactic that Buckley has taken in the months leading up to the primary. And part of the reason he says he's doing this is because in New Hampshire, there's such a tight turnaround between the primary and the general election, whereas in many other states across the country, you know, they've had primaries already or they're about to. And there's only about 8 weeks before the general. So his fear is that if there's some bad blood created, whether it's between front runners or people who are, you know, closer to the back of the pack, people have long memories and they'll remember that stuff. And the worst fear that he has is that then people won't turn out in the general. And so because it's a swing district and because it's going to be close and because Trump won the first district in 2016, Democrats are looking to get every vote that they can. Mm-hmm. And so I thought that was a really interesting tactic in light of this, you know, national conversation about the potential blue wave, so to speak, that could be using dissatisfaction with the president and help push Democrats in control of the House. And so there are obviously mixed views about this tactic. We have a little tape from one of the many Democratic candidates, Terrence O'Rourke, who actually got a phone call from Buckley because Terrence and his supporters were kind of tweeting things about Maura Sullivan, another candidate, online.
Ridiculous. You know, I'm an adult. I don't need him to tell me how to run my campaign or run my life. Primaries are supposed to be the proving grounds with the hope that the strongest candidate for the general election emerges. The first punch you take shouldn't be on September 12th from the Republican candidate.
Now, I should say there are varying degrees of feelings on this kind of play nice, bad blood situation among Democrats. But I think Terrence's point is one I heard from others, which is that this is the time that we have to point out these differences among each the massive pack of candidates.
Mm-hmm. So perpetual debate, right? I mean, this comes up every now and
then.
Yeah,
unity
campaigns.
Is always a conversation every, you know, every election, every party. But I think the reason why it's more unique here is because there haven't been many Democratic primaries, and Dean and Trent know this better than I do, where there are tons of candidates. I mean, I think this is the biggest primary that they may have ever seen. Usually, Ray Buckley and other party leaders are good at kind of whittling it down. And this time, there's 11 of them. And so it's certainly been unique and interesting to watch.
Listeners, give us a call if you have a question or comment about the week's news. The number is 1-800-892-6477. And I want to pull Robin into the conversation. Robin from Portsmouth, thank you very much. What's your question or comment?
I was listening to your conversation about Chanel, and the word diversity keeps coming up. I think I saw actually a story on WMUR, and I'm all for him. His comments were wonderful. He represents most people in the state of New Hampshire and their thoughts. We're tired of the word diversity being shoved down our throat, and I also saw the statistic that 94% of the state was, quote, white. I'm tired of being called white. I think it's ignorant.
What would you prefer to be called? Robin, what would you prefer to be called?
I prefer to be called European American. As a matter of fact, New Hampshire is quite diverse. There's Italian Americans, there's Irish Americans, there's French Americans, there's German Americans here. We are quite diverse. And actually, New Hampshire is the least racist place I've ever lived in my life. I've traveled around the world. I've lived in different states. And we are the least racist place I've ever been, and very open-minded people in New Hampshire. So, you know, I think within the last 10 years, that word diversity has really fueled a lot of nastiness and separation. I think we need to get away from that. Allow people to live where they want to live and don't force it down our throats.
Okay, Robin. Well, thank you very much. We appreciate your call and want to also get someone else to weigh in on this very same topic. Lynn from Hooksett. Lynn, thank you very much. What's your question or comment?
My comment was the word ignorance. Nobody's been using the word ignorance except the woman before me. I think for someone to refer to any generalized group as a cesspool is ignorance. To think that 1,700 drug dealers are going to come up from Lawrence is ignorant. And this person is in charge of education for the state. And when you start at the top and you have ignorance, it's terrible.
Well, thank you very much, Lynn. And I just want to clarify one of the things you made. The person who made those comments is not exactly at the top of the Department of Education. Anthony Chanel is the communications director. The man at the top, Frank Edelblue, actually did condemn those statements. He said, I and the Department of Education condemn the statement and any racist statement referring to Mr. Chanel as saying, we don't want or need New Hampshire to become any kind of cesspool. And Mr. Chanel referring to 1,300 illegal alien Dominican drug dealers moving from Lawrence to Concord. That was part of a hypothetical situation that he had spelled out. Wanted to bring those two callers into the conversation because this is certainly one of the most hot-button issues that we had to cover as news people this week, and a conversation that is sure to continue. We're going to wrap up the show in just a moment. Two more things to talk about really quickly. Dean, I wanted to get your thoughts on the latest with Christina Fey, because it seems like some good news that came out of that was that some of the dogs that were seized as part of the investigation are now being rehomed.
Yeah, I think 20 of the great 20, and there were roughly 80 Great Danes that we started with. I think 20 have found adoptive homes. There are a number of groups and agencies that are working to place these dogs. A lot of it is being done anonymously to protect a lot of the individuals involved. You know, we know with the Christina Fey, I believe she's either has or is getting ready to file yet another appeal. So this case is not over yet. She had been ordered to pay almost, she avoided jail time, but had been ordered to pay, I think, $2 million in money, in fees and fines for the care of these animals, and was only allowed to have one dog for herself. So, you know, we'll see where it goes from here. It's not over yet. As I said, she's filing an appeal, but it's good news that these dogs are finding homes.
And just so we end the show on a little bit of levity, this. Okay, so we're playing that because the Concord Police Department has put up a video that is a must-see. It's several police officers dancing.
Very highly produced video.
Yeah,
it's
they
like
spent
really
some time
high quality.
On this. Dance moves notwithstanding, you can check these out. I mean, it's been shared many, many times on Facebook. Cops dancing to funny song, pop songs like that one.
With the crime dog. Which is, I can't remember what its name is. We were trying to remember this morning. But it's quite funny.
Yeah. So I guess talking about it won't really do it justice. But we will put a link on our website so you can check it out. But just cool to see. Just really cool to see. And a good way to end the show that had so many heavy topics today. But listeners, we've posted links to all the stories we discussed today at nhpr.org. You can check them out there. The conversation will continue there as well as on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. I want to thank NHPR's Lauren Chulgin for joining us for this part of the show. Thank you very much, Lauren.
Thank you, Peter.
And thanks to Trent Spinner of the Union Leader and Dean Spiliotis for being here the whole hour. It's really great.
Thank you.
Thanks.
The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan and Andrew Perella. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. And our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening and have a great weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.